The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. It is my pleasure tonight to introduce novelist Michelle Hunnevin, who will be introducing Sue Miller. Michelle is a wonderful novelist. Her first novel, Round Rock, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times First Fiction Award, among other awards. Her second novel, James Land, and we have her novel for sale tonight, too, along with Sue's book, was a finalist for the LA Times Fiction Prize and a winner of the Southern California Booksellers Award for Fiction. Her short fiction has appeared in many magazines. She's worked, you might have seen her work as a restaurant critic and food writer in the LA Weekly or the LA Times. Her food writing has earned a James Beard Award and several American Food Journalists Award. Michelle teaches creative writing at UCLA. After their conversation, they will be signing books in the lobby. So please join me now in welcoming Michelle Hunnevin and then Sue Miller to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Louise, for that nice introduction. I'm very happy to be here again. When Louise asked me if I would introduce Sue Miller, she didn't really know that Sue and I are good old friends or that I'm actually an old hand at this. I've interviewed Sue variously for the LA Weekly and for UCLA West Wind magazine, but that was back in the Neolithic, I think. I've interviewed her for the Reader's Guide in two or three of her books, I think, and also wrote the study questions. I've been a close and hungry reader of Sue's for all these years. Now, I can tell you that Sue is the author of 10 highly acclaimed and well-loved books, 8 novels, 1 book of short stories, Inventing the Abbots, and 1 work of nonfiction, her incredibly moving and helpful The Story of My Father. I can tell you that she published her first novel, The Good Mother, when she was 43, and it made the front page of the New York Times with the kind of opening that most writers I know would murder for. And here it is. Every once in a while, a first novelist rockets into the literary atmosphere with a novel that is so accomplished that it shatters the common assumption that for a writer to have mastery, he or she must serve a long, auspicious apprenticeship. The novel arrives with all its parts gleaming, ticking, and we are filled with awe. I can also tell you that she's been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, that The Good Mother was made, this book was made into a movie starring Liam Neeson, and Family Pictures became a television drama starring Angelica Houston. She's been a Bunting Fellow, a Radcliffe Institute Fellow. She's received a Guggenheim. Her book, While I Was Gone, was an Oprah book. She's been active in New England Pen and has had various stints as a teacher of creative writing. She's presently at St. Mary's College in Moraga. But since I've known Sue for 23 years, I should at least tell you something about her that you yourself can't find out with 5 minutes on Google. I met Sue at McDowell in 1985. McDowell is a writer's colony in New Hampshire. She had just published The Good Mother, Inventing the Abbots, another feature film was made of that title story, was about to come out, and here she was starting a new novel with all the pressure that the sudden, unexpected, and glorious success can put on a novice writer. Now, McDowell is where you write all day and they even bring you lunch. Then at night, there are readings and open studios and concerts. And after that, some of us would just hang around, play records, remember records, and just dance like crazy. Now, Sue mostly wrote. I don't think I saw her at breakfast once. And she skipped other meals, too, because she was just writing. But she did come to some of the events, and she did dance. Dancing, in case you don't know, is the perfect antidote to a day spent writing. A year or two later, when I was visiting Sue in Cambridge with my friend Bruce, she cooked dinner for us, and then she, her husband Doug Bauer, and I got out her stack of 45s, and we danced like mad, just the four of us, until the neighbors called the police. They had to call them twice. To this day, when my husband and I visit, at least one night after dinner, we'll crank up the music and do some really serious dancing. Now, Sue is, with Alice Munro and Alice McDermott and William Trevor, one of the master chroniclers of domestic life, that is, of family life and of love. She is an unsentimental, sensuous writer of almost frightening intelligence and insight. Reading her last book, I was struck all over again by the fluency of her prose and by the strength of her imagination. In this day and age where critics apply the word imaginative mostly to novels structured on comic strips or time travel or genre bending, I would like here and now to reclaim that word for the realist. I know Sue well enough to say that she is not writing autobiography here or in any of her other books, though she is inevitably asked that question. Rather, she creates and sustains worlds and characters that are so sturdy and believable, so whole and convincing and particular, that they feel almost too real to be fiction. It is with great pleasure and greater pride that I give you Sue Miller.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm going to read just a very brief, sort of two connected passages from this book. It takes place in about the first, after the end, about the first third. It's actually kind of a flashback to 1971 and to a Christmas where a sort of central event of the book happens to one of the two main characters in the book named Delia Naughton. She's the senator's wife, and she's having two of her children are there for Christmas, and then one of them is brought a friend. And I'll read a short section and then jump a little and explain what happened in between and then read a final section from this passage. Delia spent Thursday in preparation. She made the beds in the room where Nancy and Carol Lee would be sleeping. This is her daughter and her daughter's friend. She sat down and wrote out menus for the long weekend and made a shopping list. She drove to the supermarket at the new mall just outside of town and went up and down the aisles, filling the shopping cart and even the low basket under it with what she thought of as largesse, feeling generous, expansive as she did so. When she came home, she made two batches of Christmas cookies and a lamb and barley soup. She was in the kitchen when Nancy and Carol Lee arrived with Evan, her son. He'd driven to the train station to get them. She went into the hallway to greet them just as Tom, her husband, came down the stairs. The girls were taking their coats off, talking with Evan. They'd left together straight from work for the train station, and they were both wearing their business outfits, heels and suits, the skirts carefully longer than was the fashion. The jacket of Nancy's suit was boxy, but Carol Lee's cut in sharply at the waist and then flared out. It made you notice her hips, her shapeliness. Delia was there first, and she hugged them both, first Nancy and then Carol Lee. She stood back to watch Tom embrace Nancy. "Sweetie," he said, throwing his arms around her. To watch Nancy, in turn, introduce him to Carol Lee with so much pride that you would have thought she'd invented the young woman. When the girls went upstairs to change and unpack, Tom followed Delia into the kitchen. "Va va voom," he said in a low voice to her, grinning. He wiggled his eyebrows up and down. I know," Delia said. She made a face at him. "But maybe you can calm down for just a minute and open some wine for me." The girls came back down in blue jeans and sweaters, transformed into kids again. And they all went into the living room and had drinks, beer for Evan, scotch, neat for Tom, and wine for all three women. Tom, as always when there was a fresh audience for his charm, laid it on, though Delia would have said he was equally flirtatious with everyone. But Carol Lee's presence made them all livelier than usual. It seemed to Delia that Evan, especially, was almost jockeying with Tom for position, plying Carol Lee steadily with questions. And she was expansive under the attention of the two men, explaining her life to them, an explanation Delia had heard piecemeal earlier. the exotic locales she'd lived in as her parents settled in different places with her father's engineering projects, the shock of American culture when she came back for college. "I had an accent," she said, "and everyone thought I was putting it on, a kind of nameless quasi-British, I don't know, maybe part British Indian post-colonial thing." She shook her head, remembering it, and her lovely hair swayed. "Everyone hated me. They thought I was such a fraud. I had to consciously teach myself Americanisms, to say things like, real nice." She seemed to take their attention for granted. She seemed certain of the fascinating quality of her own life. Well, it was fascinating, but mostly because she was a lively recounter of it. But she was generous, too. She turned to Delia at one point and said, "All this is just so gorgeous." She gestured around her. "I wish I could do what you do, make this home so beautiful, so gracious. It even smells good." She laughed. "All these wonderful female accomplishments, I'm just so in terror of." "One succumbs inch by inch," Delia said. She reached over and poured herself another glass of wine. "Oh, don't say succumb. I'd give anything to be able to, I don't know, just have all these things in my life." Delia smiled across the room at Tom and was grateful when Nancy took over, talking about the law firm, the kind of fine line the women had to walk between being tough-minded and competent, but also female, non-threatening to the men. Delia got up and passed around the crackers and cheese again, the bowl of spiced almonds. They talked about carnal knowledge, about what its tone toward women really was. They talked about Portnoy's complaint. They all agreed that part of the reason they liked the French Connection was that there was no such problem to consider. Women barely existed. At some point later, they came inevitably around to politics. Carol Lee asked Tom about the Pentagon Papers. He was expansive. He had a lot of theories about what he guessed were the complicated motives of Daniel Ellsberg, whom he knew personally. But he said he was glad the papers had come out, that everyone in Washington had known all along that the government had been lying. He said this had been and would be the making of Katherine Graham at the Washington Post. He called her Kay. Carol Lee seemed happier, more animated than Delia had seen her before. Her cheeks were flushed, though maybe that was from the wine. Delia noticed for the first time that one of her light brown eyes was slightly lazy. When she looked at you, you felt compelled by this, by the intensity of her focus, the sense of something willed in it as the slower eye pulled toward you. She looked at Tom a lot. It was the kind of thing Delia might have been bothered by in another context, but here, now, she wasn't. Later, she asked herself why. It seemed to her it must have been because of Carolee's youth and because she was Nancy's friend. Or maybe it was because Tom had made her beauty a kind of joke between Delia and himself. But there were other reasons. Tom had been unusually loving in bed the night before, and she had carried the aftermath of that with her through the day, the image of his long body bent over her in the half-dark, the feeling of his hands, his mouth on her. And then, too, at one point later in the evening when they were all sitting around with empty glasses and he was describing a disastrous camping trip they'd taken years before, he ticked off the afflictions that had struck them, pointing at each of them as he went around the room. This one had poison oak. This one got food poisoning. And this one, coming to Delia, smiling that private smile of his across at her, was so sunburned she couldn't be touched for days afterward. Something in this casual public hint of their married intimacy, and maybe too in the possessive listing of his family members, warmed Delia. Perhaps it reassured her. Perhaps it was intended to do exactly that. In any case, she didn't pick up on the currents that were passing between him and Carol Lee. The holiday progresses, and there is a moment when Delia discovers that both Tom and Carol Lee are gone. Nancy says that he's taken her to do some errands, and this puts Delia begins to be suspicious of him. He's been unfaithful before, but then dismisses it for a number of reasons. And this is Christmas, after the opening of presents. Dinner was a slow ceremonial meal with a different bottle of wine for each course and a long pause between them. As they moved into dessert, coffee, cordials, the light was fading and then gone from the windows in the dining room. Once again, the kids offered to clear and clean up. The girls went upstairs to change their clothes first. Tom retreated to his study. The phone had rung several times in the afternoon. Delia went to sit by the fire and write a letter to Brad, her third son. She told him about the weather, about their Christmas day without him, about her plan to learn to ski with Evan, about what his siblings were doing. She visualized him reading the letter 3 or 4 weeks hence, which is when it would arrive, in his mountain village in Guatemala. She could imagine his face so round and boyish. She recalled the way his hair curled down over the nape of his neck. She missed him. She heard the girls in the kitchen, Tom's intermittent voice in his study, Evan's music upstairs. By the time she finished, everything had quieted. She got up and poked at the fire. The last log crumbled into disparate sparking embers. She put the screen up in front of it. As she was about to step into the front hall, she saw Kara Lee halfway up the stairs, just making the turn out of sight. At that moment, Tom walked forward into the hallway too, coming from the kitchen. He saw Delia and smiled. "Darling," he said in his light, urgent voice. And Delia watched, as invisible to him, Kara Lee turned back on the stairs, her face lit and expectant. Delia stepped into her sight line and answered him, "What?" As Tom began talking, something about business in Washington, Delia could see Kara Lee in her peripheral vision quickly vanishing around the corner to the second floor. Even as she heard Tom out, keeping her voice calm, she felt her heart racing. She was seeing again the eagerness, no, the avidity, in the girl's face when she heard Tom's endearment, and she knew, she felt it as an undeniable certainty that something had already begun between them. Tom was going to have to go back early the next day, that's what he was saying. There was some trouble with a bill that had passed just before Christmas, some negotiating he needed to be there for. "I see," she said. "And so it goes." He lifted his hands, palms up, helpless. His mouth made its small, self-mocking smile. "I'm sorry, really. I thought we'd have a nice long vacation together." Delia was certain he was lying, but she willed herself to believe him. She willed it to be true. There was a meeting. There would be a meeting. He was sad to go. Just as she willed it to be true that yesterday Kara Lee had a big batch of Xeroxing to get done in town, that there'd been other work lined up ahead of hers, so that they decided to go for lunch while they waited. To go for lunch, to buy the groceries Delia needed, and yes, to tour the town. And even then they'd had to wait a little longer when they stopped back to pick the Xeroxing up. He packed that night, since his flight was so early the next morning. He'd arranged for a car to take him to the airport. She lay in bed and watched him move around the room. The suitcase was open by her feet, and there was a little bounce she could feel each time he added something to it. He was quick and efficient. He'd done this hundreds of times before. As he was getting into bed beside her, he said, "When will you come back, you think?" There was something too casual, too relaxed in his tone. "To Washington," she said. "I don't know. Evan is staying all this coming week, so I'll want to be here for him. And then there were a few invites I said yes to, though that was for both of us. I'll figure it out. Will you let me know?" "Of course, I wouldn't spring myself on you. Though that sounds kind of interesting, actually." He kissed her lightly. When he left the next morning, he warned her that he'd be out late at meetings and pretty unavailable by phone, he said. "I'll call you when I can." Later in the morning, Kara Lee unexpectedly left, too, a day earlier than she and Nancy had planned. She had some stuff to prepare for work that she just hadn't got done over the weekend because she was having such a good time. She needed to get back and just push through it, an all-nighter, she thought. Evan and Nancy drove her to the train station and put her on. Delia didn't call Tom that night, or the next, or all that following week. She didn't want to hear the telephone ring and ring in the empty house in Washington. Thanks. Thank you. And thanks again, Michelle, for that wonderful introduction.
Now, I've known Sue for long enough to know that when she finishes a book, she goes to a kind of fallow period. In which she wonders which will come next. She even despairs of getting another idea, announces maybe she's slowing down or maybe there won't be another book. But then something snags a hold of her psyche and the whole structuring and imagining and note-taking and researching begins again. So what I want to know is, with this novel, The Senator's Wife, what started that process? What started to snag you? I know it's not just one thing.
There were a lot of things, but I had in my notebook just a fact that had interested me for a long time, and it was that an acquaintance of ours, a couple who were acquaintances of ours, actually good friends of good friends, but whom we didn't know well, I knew about them that the wife, after their divorce, long after their divorce, and she had was with someone else, he got cancer and was ill, and she and her husband, she took him in, her former husband, and nursed him until he died. And this struck me as such an interesting and complicated and compelling event that I was, I just began to explore it and to sort of make notes about what that would be like and how it would work and who the characters might be that I could conjure up who would be in a sort of parallel situation. As the book sort of took shape in my mind, it changed a lot, and there were lots of other things that fed into it too. But that was the initial sort of spark for it. There was also this notion I had, in part because of taking care of my father when he had Alzheimer's disease. You know, I was sort of thinking initially of the ex-husband as coming home and not being particularly dear, and the way in which I thought how would it work that the wife would come to care for him somehow? And it seemed to me that taking care of him would be the way. I thought of sort of physically taking care of my father and how that had made me much more comfortable with him and made me much more aware of my love for him. And it struck me that it was very much like taking care of a new baby, that one learns to love the baby by really tending to the baby, by touching the baby, by doing all of the sort of mundane chores of taking care that are involved, but that involve a lot of physical contact. So I began to sort of speculate about sort of having two women in the book then, one of whom would be taking care of an infant, while the other one would be taking care of a person at the end of life. And then sort of the question was sort of how to bring these women together. And I did it very neatly by having them, the younger couple, buy half of a double house in which the older woman was living on the other side. But much changed as I sort of plotted it out. And in fact, it turned out that the older woman was still in love with her husband and had just been separated from him for a long time. This is Delia, the senator's wife, who they never divorce after these events, which I read to you, but they don't live together. But then she does take him back in at a certain point in the novel, well before the end of the novel, at the same time that her neighbor, Mary, is struggling to find a way to love this new baby. So in fact, it turned out to be in this novel the younger woman who has the harder time sort of falling in love with her dependent person than the old woman does.
And when did it become a political novel then? What made you decide to introduce politics into it?
I was really interested in sort of the having there be a difference between the personalities of the two women. I thought of Delia as being very much like my New England aunts, who are very witty and charming and funny and engaging and completely private, so that you can spend, you know, a week they're now not with us anymore, I'm afraid, but it was the case that you could spend a week with one of them and feel you had been, you know, just had a great time, and then come away not knowing really what they were feeling about things, whether they were suffering with something private. I mean, that there was just some final curtain between you and them. And so I thought of Delia as being this kind of New England-y character, very private, very engaging and charming, but finally someone who was sort of unknowable. And the younger woman I thought of as being a sort of modern person. I'd been reading a lot about, people posting intimate details about themselves online and so forth. This book takes place, most of the action, in the early 90s, so that wasn't such an issue then. But I thought of Mary as being a person with few boundaries, a kind of person who, from Delia's point of view, behaves inappropriately a lot of the time. And there are things she does in this book which are inappropriate. So I began to think about issues of privacy and public life. And it just occurred to me that it would be interesting to throw into this mix the possibility that Delia's husband was a public person, so that the particular agony involved in his infidelity, which is the thing which separates them, is something that is not quite exposed publicly, because these things take place in his infidelities when they're together, take place in the 60s and 70s, before the era when these things were public. But people knew, and Bedelia knew that people knew, people that she knew, knew. And she also had to be sort of complicit in his campaigns, and just by staying married to him, in a certain sense, complicit in keeping this secret from the public. And that seemed to me to be another sort of interesting aspect to this whole question of what's private, what's public, what we can sort of know about other people, even in marriage. I mean, that's one of the things that I sort of wanted to look at, how well, and even how well people truly know themselves or understand themselves in some way. So it was really a question about how much one can know of anyone, but it seemed to me it would be interesting to have this, that one of the people be a public figure to sort of complicate things.
Well, you must have had some idea, of course, that the book would be relatively relevant in an election year, but I doubt that you anticipated it being quite as relevant as it was last week.
Right. The book was late, so it would have come out prior to an election year, if I'd gotten it on time. So it was sort of a little bit of happenstance that it came out exactly when it did, which was, you know, this past January when everyone was gearing up for all these big primaries, and some of them had happened already. So.
Well, I understand that you were actually asked to speak to the subject last week, but you refused, or you didn't?
I actually didn't get the call until the person already had to submit the article, but then I just said I really didn't want to anyway. I really feel that, I was asked to comment on it as a sort of expert on the political wife whose husband has betrayed her, which I know absolutely nothing about, of course. I mean, I invented a person for my own nefarious purposes who is the wife of a politician whose husband has betrayed her. And I invent quite specific reasons why this person actually campaigns with him after he's betrayed her, actually continues to love him after he's betrayed her, actually takes him back when he's ill in his old age. But these would surely not be anyone else's reasons. And I think every situation like this has all of its own complications, and I really didn't want to become an expert on this.
No, I understand that you didn't want to become an expert, but I think that you sell short the power of imagination and empathy that a novelist has, and that a novelist who's thought as deeply as you have about this character might actually have some insights. I don't know which, but certainly
there certainly may be things which are parallel, but I wouldn't venture a guess about them as mm-hmm. to which they are. There are many things which are obviously very different from between Delia's life and the life of the Spitzers, and very different indeed. But and it may be that people reading about Delia would their sense of the possibility might be enlarged. They might actually feel some sense that they could imagine it. And certainly for me, the task was to imagine being Delia, and still loving Tom.
Yeah.
So I feel that, and I think for a writer in any with any character, the task is to imagine being them, the character. And the pleasure of writing is in part to imagine that, to sort of inhabit a life quite different from your own, and live it for a while. So it seems to me that someone reading the book might have some insight into some of that, but I'm not sure
right.
the degree to which that would be true.
Now, on the Huffington Post, you'll see that I did some reading on this. A therapist pointed out that in these marriages, and she granted said this with a grain of salt, but she said that Hillary, for example, made a deal to stay in her marriage, and that deal had to do with holding her family together and also with serving her own ambition. What is Delia's deal in the book? She makes a deal to stay in this marriage. What do you think it is?
In the short run, the deal is to help him politically, because she feels that this is the best part of who he is, that she's a believer in him, that she wants him to get reelected, and in exchange for that, she sort of wonders herself about what it is she's getting, and she can think of several things, a kind of power over him. She's sort of fled him and gone to Paris for some months before she consents to come back, and wants an apartment that he ends up buying for her in Paris, so there's that. But then, over the longer term, Delia is convinced that she can't live with him again. She's been so rudely surprised by this final infidelity with a friend of her daughter's. But she loves him. So what their arrangement is for about 20 years is that Delia, they don't divorce, and Delia calls him when she wants to see him, which sometimes a year passes or more, and sometimes it's several months. But the terms are hers, and since she feels in control of that, she feels that it's tolerable. She simply sort of separates herself from whatever his life may be, sort of outside of their relationship. But their relationship, which is extremely private, is secret, actually. As far as everyone else is concerned, they're amicably separated. Their relationship continues in a loving way, but one in which she's in charge of. So that's the deal that she makes, and he assents to, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Well, then, talk if you would talk a little bit about Mary. But the one question that I had about them is that Delia really resists Mary in a big way. Mary
is the other woman on the other side of the...
She's the neighbor, and she's young. She's moved into this house that her husband has taken because he's a little bit starstruck because he thinks the senator himself might live next door. She's working class. She was happy in her little house before, in her little one-room apartment. The opening line about that was Mary loved her little home, but then she gets together with this man and moves into this house that they can barely afford, but that has a prestigious neighbor. And she becomes intrigued with Delia, and Delia just, it's more than just Delia's natural armor. Delia resists her. Why?
I think Delia doesn't at first. At first, it's simply the way she is with everyone. She's very charming to Mary. She welcomes her. She takes her places in this town because Mary's new to the town. But then after Mary has her baby, Mary has a great deal of difficulty attaching to her baby. Delia is impatient with her. Delia is at the same time taking care of Tom and feels that Mary should understand that she's just impatient with her inability to love the child and with her sort of, she keeps sort of trying to talk to Delia and trying to use Delia as a friend and an intimate, and Delia simply doesn't want to be involved in that way and is impatient with her.
I have to say that Mary's labor is one of the most sort of astonishing things I've read in a long time. It's a troubled labor, and it's beautifully written, but it is harrowing. It's really harrowing.
Thank you, Michelle.
Well, that's, realism for you.
Yeah. Ouch.
No, I mean, I think it's an amazing scene. But some critics, and maybe even Delia's daughter, Nancy, suggests that Delia's attraction to Tom is addictive. And certainly he's a sex addict. He, says he can't control himself. And she may or may not be playing out some compulsion, similar compulsion, in kind of a minor key. She is, it seems, in control for a while. And then she sort of gets him when he's ill and takes care of him. How real is her power? I mean, how is...
Well, I think that's open in the book and left open. I mean, I think there are a lot of questions at the end of the book about what, which I wanted to leave open, about what Delia did and why she did it, and what Tom did and why he did it, and you know, to what degree she understood what she was doing when she did it. And I, you know, I think Delia is sort of dazzled by her great good fortune at the end of the book in a certain way. And I really don't want to sort of speculate beyond that. I mean, I really made an effort to sort of make it something that the reader could sort of engage with, I think.
I had a minister once who said that forgiveness really only makes sense after there's been some remorse or some change in behavior. And yet, forgiveness is a theme throughout this book. I wonder, can you, do you feel that Delia forgives Tom at a certain point, or that she...
I think she feels she has.
She has.
And in a way, I think she, this is also a deal that she feels she's made to come to some peace because she's forgiven him, that things will be all right because of that, because she's managed to do that. She's sort of been rewarded. Mm-hmm. She really articulates that to herself in almost those terms. And I think that there's an open question about that with her. I mean, I think she has struggled very hard to forgive him.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written 8 novels now, and some novels have similar concerns and resonate with, you know, some, and they must be clustering in different clusters now. If someone particularly liked this book, what of your other books would you suggest that they, what are its cluster mates?
Well, I can actually think of its clustering with different ones for different reasons. There's another book very much concerned with a long-term marriage among older people called The Distinguished Guest, which I think might be in which they divorce, actually. But their connection is, and the question of forgiveness also, and the question of self-understanding is one that is very important in that book. That book, too, concerns the son of this older woman. But I also think, you know, in terms of I don't. Well, that's probably a good one.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah. That's what I would think.
Okay.
I would think I thought that. Also, you write... Well, I was going to ask you about women in real estate because I'm particularly interested. Sue writes marvelously about women and their houses and what their houses mean to them, but I think that that came clear from the reading that you did. And so I think I'll just ask you about, I know that you're teaching now and that you haven't taught for a while, and so can you talk a little bit about teaching and how you're enjoying it, and can fiction be taught, and...
Et cetera. I think that certainly you can help almost anyone. You can help them at a very basic level, if that's the level they're struggling at. And I think people who are, you know, I try essentially to act as some very fine editors have acted toward me in helping me with my book, with various of my books, when I have very gifted students. I mean, really just sort of try to make it as strong as it can possibly be. But I certainly feel with the group of students I'm teaching now that I'm working at many levels, and I've actually had a lot of, you know, you may stay after class to learn about the comma. That's sort of... if you feel you need help with the comma. I'm working at many levels at once.
Yes.
With this class. But I like teaching primarily because, I mean, I think an issue for every writer is really what else you're going to do that keeps you in touch with other people, that sort of gets you out of your pajamas and into the world a little bit. And certainly for me, often I've had to do some research around each book, which has gotten me into different worlds from the ones I usually occupy. But I enjoy teaching just because I like to meet the people, I like to meet the other faculty. It's just sort of gets me out of my own head and into the concerns of other people for a while. I've done other things at various times, but I think, I mean, the great thing about teaching is the flexibility it affords you, that you can sort of control the amount of time it takes out of your life. And so if you're trying to write at the same time, it's not just a great struggle, which I think it can be with other kinds of jobs. For a while, I was the chair of Penn New England, and that was about a half-time job, unpaid. But that was also tremendous fun, in terms of starting programs and in the school systems in Boston and in prisons and then just running events for writers in the Boston area too. So both of those things have been things that have worked for me. But I think writers solve this. I mean, Hemingway drank a quart of scotch a day and went fishing. I could do that too. but somehow teaching seems more my pace, I guess, or something like that.
Now, one of the great pleasures of being friends with Sue over all these years is that we have a continuing conversation about reading. So I'm going to ask you here, what are you reading now and what do you recommend?
Well, I just read a book that I would recommend two-thirds of. And I can't remember the writer's name at the moment. It's called Beginner's Greek. It's a charming novel, but then it's a little too charming at the end. But I loved it for two-thirds of it. And it's beautifully written. It's his first novel. I was reading the letters, actually, of Martha Gellman, and then a biography of Martha Gellman this spring. Last spring I read the letters of Martha Gellman, which is probably why the Hemingway thing occurred to me. What have I been reading? Good Lord, I can never remember when someone asks me what I've been reading. But I have War and Peace, the new translation that I got for Christmas, and I haven't started it yet. I'm looking forward to it very much, but I know that it sort of will take me out for a couple of months when I do begin it, or a month anyway. Can't remember, Michelle. Sorry.
That's okay. Let's see. Well, is there any question after this book tour that you've been at, that nobody yet has asked you about this book that you would like to answer? Because this is your opportunity.
People have asked me a lot of questions, even around this book, about my own marriage and, just things would so much rather not have had to find a gracious way out of. I think, one of the things that's been interesting to me is in talking to people about the book is how much more focus there's always been on the senator's wife than on Mary, the other character. And I think, part of that is that it did come out in this political season, and with Hillary Clinton as one of the candidates, someone who famously has sort of had to struggle with this issue in quite different ways from Delia, and ways that I wouldn't begin to understand. But to me, Mary is as compelling a character as Delia, and in a very different way, and as far away from me as Delia is. And it's interesting to me that she sort of seems to have gotten lost in the discussion of the book. I mean, it's partly my fault. I called the book The Senator's Wife. And some of that is because Delia is so focused on her. I mean, everyone is focused on her.
She is the emotional heart of the book, though.
I think so. Yeah. It's true. But it is also true that Mary occupies about half of the book, and very little discussion goes on about her in the reviews, and certainly many fewer questions have arisen about her. I think Logically so, since most people who've come to readings that I've done haven't yet read the book, so the obvious, the character of most, you know, immediate interest is the senator's wife. But my question is, my question to other people is, how come not more Mary, I guess? And I don't know what the question would be that they would have asked me about her, but it's intriguing to me that there has been so little, I guess, about her, in a way. Because I find her a very compelling character.
She is compelling. I do say one thing about her that I also say about my husband, which is that she's very quick to forgive herself.
Michelle, it's 10 years later. 14 years later, I think, as a matter of fact. Anyway.
I think now we'll open it up for questions from the audience. If there are any. Okay.
Oh, there's a mic.
Microphone right here. Good.
Hi. I'm a longtime admirer of yours. I haven't read this book yet, but I love the way you do conversations. Your conversations are so real. They don't seem phony or false. My book group recently read Lost in the Forest, and we took it very personally, the abuse of the child and the way some of the adults behaved. We sounded very much like it had happened to one of us or to somebody we knew. You're a brilliant writer. Thank you.
Well, what a nice question. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As a Bostonian and Cantabrigian, everything is always so perfect and so reminiscent. And this, I've read, I think, everything you've ever written, and happily so. But let me go to Mary for a moment. She's compelling, but I didn't like her. And I also, I left the book feeling very frustrated.
Others have too. The book ends with Mary, and Delia is gone at the end of the book. And I think that's hard for people. And I don't want to talk about the ending because if someone hasn't read it. But I certainly sympathize with that. In a certain way, though, I felt that Mary made use of Delia, but she made good use of her, finally.
I was just curious about your the provocative point in your books. What does it feel like when you finally get to write what you have imagined? You know, this moment in the book that will startle people. I mean, have you prepared for that so long ago that you? I just can't imagine what it's like to be holding that within yourself and have to write the whole book to get to that point.
Well, sometimes they occur earlier in the book, you know, and sometimes there's more than one. but certainly, you know, when I write a book, I have a sense of what's going to be in it. Not every single thing, obviously, but I know in a general sense what's going to happen, and those kinds of events are very much part of the way I think about things. The kinds of events that turn the book or make the, you know, sort of turn the action of the book and make it move in a new direction, make some sort of previous things clearer, the meaning of them, and so forth. It's thrilling. It's always, they always seem to me difficult scenes to write, challenging scenes to write, and make very clear in terms of what everybody is doing and feeling and why they're happening and what their connection is to the rest of the book, but also to write them in a way that makes them sort of humanly understandable and kind of, my wish is to make them seem sort of inevitable in a certain way, and therefore necessary to the book in some way, and necessary humanly among the characters I've created, but also for them to be surprising and to change the way the reader feels about things. But that's terribly exciting. And some of what's exciting about it is that it's hard to write, to kind of make that happen in a way that will seem real, but will also sort of be inclusive of the feelings of the characters and the motivations of the characters and so forth, you know, which involves conversation and action and, you know, getting there without forcing it, that kind of thing. But it's terribly exciting. I mean, there's something I think, was it Flaubert, isn't it, who talks about writing very cold, you need to be cold. And there's something very, you know, just in your cold heart, you're just thrilled to be doing this as a writer, I think. That's
good. I did have a question about Mary. I see Mary at the beginning of the book being very uneasy with things and questioning. And do you see her at the end of the book not doing that anymore? Is she now not questioning? Is she completely at ease? Or is there still going to be, I sort of missed that. I even, it was kind of annoying at the beginning. Uh-huh. But that was a part of her, and I saw her at the end becoming so settled.
She is settled. I mean, life goes on. I don't know that she'll always be settled, but she's sort of subsumed. I mean, she's, you know, taken up with what she's doing at the moment and being very startled that that she can be happy in this universe that she's in, that she's made around herself. I think, you know, it's not anything she wanted. It sort of happened to her almost by mistake. It happened to her by mistake. But not anything she was ready for. I don't know that, I mean, there's long life after this life that you are so taken up with, too. I mean, it seemed to me in writing the last pages that that the sort of question of the sense she makes of things may reflect some of her own I'm not sure how well she understands herself in those moments exactly, too, which may, you know, she's not cured of being Mary, in other words, I don't think.
I haven't read it yet. I look forward to it. But in the real world that you touched, that we've touched on in the discussion, Elliot Spitzer and the Clintons, there was a lot of public response about their spouse's response to the betrayal. A lot of judgment, a lot of people thinking they knew what the woman should have done. And I'm wondering if in fiction, if in this book, if you're getting any kind of response like that with, you know, people responding that she should have acted in another way or something.
Absolutely, yeah. But that's, you know, it's always been true. I mean, I had a character that in the very first book that I wrote who is in a custody battle, and people wrote me afterwards that she was so passive. She should have done this, she should have done that, she should have been a valiant warrior for this. And the same is true for this. I mean, that people have been very angry about what Delia does, and what Mary does, too, for that matter. You know, these horrible people. And, you know, there have been a few reviews that have actually said that. You know, this is a book about horrible people, you know. And certainly the question of, you know, whether Delia should be forgiving and that she's so accommodating and why does she do it have been asked me very directly at various readings. And I don't have an answer. I mean, I certainly feel as though it was a different world that Delia grew up in from the world that we inhabit now. And, you know, she never expected to have her own career, and she's been her life has been to be this the politician's wife. She's in her 50s when this happens, the event that I read out loud. And she has still, you know, a child in college and in school. I mean, I think she is a different era, a different universe that she comes from. Certainly, you know, there were friends of my parents who had parallel kinds of things happen to them and got back together eventually. And I think it was much more typical then for that to be the case. But even so, contemporary, mostly women, have sort of said, I just couldn't stand it. You know, how could she do that, essentially?
One last one.
Have you gotten any feedback from politicos, especially political men, regarding this novel? And I'm not asking for names, but just feedback from the political sphere. And then secondly, being an educator, I wanted to know how were you influenced when you were young in writing, and how would you encourage young people from 10-year-olds or older to write?
I haven't gotten any response from anybody in the political world, except there was a review in the Wall Street Journal by the wife of a senator who said that she thought this kind of behavior was not exclusively political. She wished to assert that this could happen in any universe. And as to, I mean, I think sort of what I wish people did more was read. I'm always startled when I have students who want to be writers and they just really haven't read a lot. And I think that that's basically all I would say to people who want to be a writer. I had a period in my life when I was a single mother and I was working in daycare. And we didn't have a TV in my house, and that was a conscious choice of mine because of my son. And I can remember I just read every single night. That's what I did. And that was my true apprenticeship as a writer, was reading and noticing, you know, and really asking myself, how does he do that? How does she do that? How did he make me feel that thing that I felt? And then going back and looking so carefully at the language and you know, just trying to understand how words, you know, affected me, and being very careful to look at exactly what the words were and the way they were, with the various ways they were being used. And I think I can remember someone, I had a little apartment in my house, and the woman who lived upstairs had this boyfriend, and years later he said to me, you know, I used to go up and he could see through the stairs. They were built on the outside. He could see me lying on the couch reading. He said, I used to feel so sorry for you night after night. You'd just be lying there by yourself reading. And I thought, how extraordinary. I mean, I was having the most wonderful time. And it was I think it's hard for people to give themselves over to it in that way anymore. There really is so much else going on. But I feel as though, unless you have given yourself over to it in that way, why would you even want to be a writer? Unless it's something that has just thrilled you since you were a child, and continues to thrill you, you know, tale-telling at its most basic when you're little, and then sort of the language which controls the emotional response to tale-telling as you get older. So basically all I would ever say is just read more. Read all the time. Just read.
That's a perfect place for us to end.
Thank you for
coming. Oh, and now we have to dance.
Did you bring the records?
Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.